Hi, what's up, podcast people and soundtrack geniuses around the world. You're listening to The Soundcast, the official podcast of TrackSounds.com. And on this podcast, we talk all things film, television, and video game music. That is soundtracks. I am Christopher Coleman, and joining me for this auspicious episode is...
Dane Walker, composer, in parentheses.
Kristen Romanelli.
Whoa, okay, I'll jump in. I'm Eric Woods from Cinematic Sound Radio.
I'm from Very Filmscar Monthly pauses. Online. It wasn't on there, so I felt weird.
So literal.
I am.
You're bringing down podcasting single-handedly with your all-men podcast episodes and now not fulfilling your title.
All right. You're just a force of chaos.
I'm leaving all this in, so go ahead and continue.
Today is Monday, January 7th, 2019, and this is episode 128 of the Soundcast, where we review the original score for Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse by Daniel Pemberton.
You can find all episodes of the Soundcast at thesoundcast.com or iTunes or Stitch Radio or TuneIn Radio or Google Podcasts or on Spotify. Wherever you do listen, please give us a rating and a review because it helps us to know that you're listening. And if you give us good feedback, it can help us to make the show even better. You can send your feedback as well to soundcast@tracksounds.com. Leave us a voicemail on the famous Speak Pipe widget, or you can hit us up on Twitter at Audio Soundcast or on Facebook. Well, welcome back, everyone. Does everyone have a Golden Globe hangover?
No.
That was a weird show, man.
Because I stopped watching after Jeff Bridges.
Oh, wow. How dare you?
When the Americans won, I was like, I'm going to rewatch the last two episodes of the Americans.
Immediately?
Yep. Okay. So I queued them up on Amazon Prime, and I watched them, and I wept the departure of a great show.
Well, it was probably, I don't know, I didn't think it was the best Golden Globe show ever. I don't know, what do you guys think overall about the show?
I was watching it in the ER with my son and his broken elbow, and
yeah.
It was like all that was on the TV we could let him watch, you know. Uh-huh. And I mean, there weren't even cartoons or anything on, and he was getting into it because I had a little thing with him. Let's see who can guess which one's going to win or whatever. But it was dull. I mean, really dull. Sadly, dull. Actually,
Jim Carrey was funny.
Yes.
Yeah. For
he should host the
three
Oscars.
Minutes or so, I think.
I just think Andy Samberg's really cute, so.
Okay.
It's very Saturday Night Live jokes.
Yeah.
And most of them usually miss, maybe once in a while they'll hit, but I'm still curious about the, what was it, the vaccines.
Oh my gosh, that was ridiculously stupid.
Weird.
What happened there? Was that for real?
I don't think so. Willem Dafoe looked like he was like genuinely terrified.
Yeah.
I was watching that, all I could think was, gosh, I hope they have a real good supply of needles because that's really gross.
Yeah, I can't imagine that would, the liability on that,
that
would just be
safe.
Through the roof. Yeah.
But you know what?
They went after anti-vaxxers too. Like they turned it into a whole thing. Like
they did. It was flat. It was not funny.
It went by quick, and I think that's what the Oscars need to do. They just need to fly through it all just quickly. There was no BS, and I mean honestly,
the Oscars is all BS. It's 100% BS.
And I don't necessarily think. Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, I like the celebration of film, and so I don't want them to rush through that. They can rush through some of the other stuff, but I like them to take their time. I mean, that one, I always think about that Oscars where they had all like five or six people come up on the stage, and they went through each of the nominees one at a time. And they really took their time. It was really classy. I think that was the one with Michael Giacchino doing the music. All of that. It was really classy, really well done. But, I mean, the Golden Globes has never been that. The Golden Globes has always been its cheap kind of stepbrother to the Oscars.
It's a trashy show. It's the drunken stepbrother, yeah.
So what did you guys think of Bohemian Rhapsody taking Best Picture? I couldn't believe it, to be honest. I haven't seen it, so I haven't seen it, so I really shouldn't judge, but
I got
a
news alert on my phone for that, and I thought it was an error.
I wish it was an error. Of all the films, that was like the bottom. Like,
and Green Book winning screenplay?
I thought it was a decent screenplay.
Over Beale Street?
No, maybe not. I mean, yeah, I wasn't too upset about that one. But Bohemian Rhapsody's
so
Best Picture just didn't. I thought if I had to pick one that wasn't going to win it, it would have been that one. And I could be wrong because I haven't seen it. But
so weird.
I haven't seen Bohemian Rhapsody, but Twitter exploded the moment that happened. And I've just read so many things of it being kind of just this average movie with one great performance. And so I was kind of surprised by it, thinking that maybe A Star Is Born, I think, was the front runner going into it.
I thought
and
that
I'm
was
surprised it didn't win. And I was kind of iffy on that movie as well. Green Book, I was reading up on the controversy of that movie while the Golden Globes was going on, and I can see why people are.
There's a controversy with Green Book?
Yes. Yeah. They basically.
I don't buy it.
They don't necessarily go. Like, the title Green Book, they don't even go into it. They gloss over it, and so, I mean, again, I haven't seen it to comment on it, but I have read that there is a controversy with it, which is why it winning screenplay was so questionable, because they totally missed the point of what the Green Book is all about. But then again,
but that's not what the movie's about.
Yeah, I mean,
it's
movie's
not
more
about the Green Book. It's
about
the relationship.
It's not about the Green Book, and it's not really even about Dr. Shirley, which is a shame. It's more about Viggo Mortensen's character.
Yeah, it's
so
really
it's
centers
really
around
sort
him.
Of mistitled.
But he's the one, if I'm not correct, that actually came up with the Green Book. Is that right? So, I mean, like, if
no.
you're naming...
No.
I
no,
thought
no,
he was
no,
the
no.
one.
Green Book has been something that's been around since, like, the 1930s or earlier.
What was his... was it not Viggo Mortensen's... Whose character... I've read something about his character.
It was his character's son who wrote the screenplay.
Sorry?
It was his character's son in real life that wrote the screenplay, or at least had some part in the screenplay.
I think he wrote it, because he's the one that got up and accepted the award.
Yeah, I don't know if he wrote it 100% by himself, but he's definitely on it. He might have, but you're right, he did give the speech for it.
Okay.
The controversy part, it didn't impact me in terms of, did I like this movie? Do I think it was an effective movie, you know? I kind of balked at some of the pushback that came from critical circles on this film.
I mean, I think the big thing about Bohemian Rhapsody is Bryan Singer's involvement in it, and that's what's got people so.
Well, it is that, but it's also kind of how it glosses over Freddie Mercury's sexuality.
Sure.
And which is
it's always
choice, and it glosses over
his
illness.
Again,
and,
to Christopher's point, is like, is it a good movie? I mean, that's the thing that we are there to see. I mean, if you want to see something factual, go watch a documentary.
Watch a documentary, correct.
And that again is my argument for something like Braveheart, which is completely 100% totally historically inaccurate.
Right.
But the movie is not bad because of that. It is still a great movie. I can separate the two. I can go and watch a great movie, and then I can do the research for myself. But I'm not going to discredit a movie if it's not 100% factually correct, and no film is unless it's at least a documentary.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the way I would see it is if Bohemian Rhapsody is a good movie. And I understand that, you know, with the Bryan Singer controversy. But then again, you know, once he was fired, you still have hundreds of thousands of people that are working on this movie.
Sure.
Putting it together. And I'm shocked. I didn't even hear John Ottman's name at all last week.
I heard that
he was pretty much the hero of that movie to assemble it and edit it. And not to hear his name at all, and I'm not sure whether that's because of his close association with Bryan Singer, but that's what I think. Mainly it was Bohemian Rhapsody is sort of a mediocre movie. Again, I can't comment on it because I haven't seen it, But then also, it was like nobody wanted to see a movie with Bryan Singer associated with it win, especially with everything that's going on in the world.
The Hollywood Foreign Press wanted to see it. Sorry? They made it. I said the Hollywood Foreign Press wanted to see it win. So
yeah, for sure.
Somebody did.
And then
did.
Again, what are they like 80 people, right?
So something like that. And I don't know what their marketing campaign was, their awards campaign, right. Probably pretty impressive. I don't know. It might have been. That was a shock. Just a complete shock to me. And then the best score went to Justin Hurwitz's First Man. I'd have to say I was pretty shocked at that, too. But going down the list, Eric, you did say, and I think it was episode 125, that you thought First Man or Black Panther would win. So you're the only one who mentioned First Man as a potential will win right there.
I've just seen it on Twitter and in kind of critic circles and everybody just praising that score.
Yeah.
And especially one particular scene that really stands out for a lot of people who have seen it. I was disappointed that Black Panther didn't win.
We all said it should win, and I think everyone said it three of you said it would win. I was the only one who said A Quiet Place would win, because that would have been the weirdest thing in the world.
That would have been, man.
And it wouldn't have been out of place with last night.
That would have been
night.
Funny.
Yes, it would.
You know, because I'm pretty sure Beltrami would have been shocked, too.
What was weird for me is when they started playing the music from First Man, I was like, oh, yeah, I did like that. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, yeah. I'd forgotten about it my head.
The only thing weirder would have been Bohemian Rhapsody winning Best Picture. Oh, wait, that did happen.
No, I really, really like First Man, and I wanted Black Panther to win, but I'm just as happy with First Man. I like Justin Hurwitz, and
you didn't say
it's been really interesting to watch him.
Could you play back what you said actually on the show?
I could. I'll drop a clip in right now. Actually, she was loath to try to pick. Oh no, she did pick, and she went with Black Panther.
And went with Black Panther.
Yeah, but there was no love for First Man at that time, so I don't know what's going on right now. But it's okay. It's okay.
I think I said I liked First Man.
I don't think you did. I just re-listened to it.
I'm pretty sure I did.
Oh, I'm sure you said you liked First Man, but there was no, it will win.
No, I didn't say it will win, but I do say that I'm just as happy that he gets Golden Globe. I mean, I don't put a lot of stock into the Golden Globes anyway, so whatever.
Yeah, yes. Understandable stance, and that's probably only increased with this last show. All right. Well, that's our thoughts about the Golden Globes. On to the next award show. I have no idea which is the next one. Usually, like, the Critics' Choice is usually before the Golden Globes, so I don't know what's coming this year. If the Critics' Choice Awards happened, I missed it completely. But
isn't the Producers Guild something big now?
Are
they starting to televise that?
And the Screen Actors Guild.
Those are kind of precursors to what you might see nominated for the Oscars.
Yep. I think they have been. So we're going to move on to our first title of the night, which is Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, with the original score by Daniel Pemberton. The film was released on December 14th, 2018 by Sony. As of Sunday-ish, it had raked in a mere $234 million worldwide. But the Rotten Tomatoes scores are pretty positive, 97% from critics, 94% from regular folk. Let's talk about it. Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. Eric, what did you think about the film?
I loved it. I really loved it. And I didn't think that I needed this type of movie in my life at this moment. But I mean, not to say that I haven't had a great time in the movies or at the movies this year, because I mean, Ready Player One was a fantastic time in the movies, but I didn't expect to love it as much as I did. And I wanted to immediately jump back into line and see it again. And that's the only regret I have right now, is that I've only seen it once. And I saw it maybe 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. So recalling a lot of what happened.
Yeah.
It might be a little difficult for me tonight. Sure. But I just, because there was so much going on.
Yeah. I was a little busy.
But I could remember just watching and going, wow, I haven't seen anything like this before. And that's really odd to say that, you know, at this time, you know, 2018, it's like, I haven't seen anything like this before.
Yes. Yeah.
But, you know, if you had said that there's going to be this new animated Spider-Man movie coming out last year, and I would have gone, well, who cares? Like, we don't need this. Yep. And I'm so glad it came out. And I just recall at the end of this film going, this should get a Best Picture nomination. It should win all the animation awards. It's a fabulous screenplay. The direction is brilliant. It should get an art direction award. And it won't, because it's animation, but man, the environment, the voice cast, the animation, the story, it was brilliant. It was all brilliant. It's one of my favorite animated movies of all time. It's now one of my top five favorite superhero films of all time. I loved it, and I can't wait to experience it again.
Yeah, agreed. Kristen, what'd you think?
Holy moly. That's a fun movie. Yeah, it's been a long time since a movie has generated that kind of joy in me. And yeah, this is a fun, beautiful movie that I don't know. I felt this really weird, like, I don't know if it's because I'm a woman in her late 30s, but I had like this super maternal instinct towards Miles, where I was just like, oh, you're a little growing Spider-Man. It's so cute. It was weird, but it was a great time.
I didn't expect that in your reaction to the movie. That's cool.
It was a really fun experience. And when I was in the theater, I went to a local theater, so not like a big AMC deal, but it's like a little independent neighborhood theater. And it was packed, and there were tons of kids in there. It was at a 4:30 screening. And they were all super hyped at the end as the credits were rolling. And they all like stayed in their seats through the credits. They were talking about the movie, about how awesome it was. So overall, great experience, both on screen and in the theater.
Nice. And what about you, Dane?
Oh, it was a great movie. I took my son with the broken arm. we went to see it the weekend it came out, and he was really psyched about it. I enjoyed it a lot. It had one flaw, but otherwise, it was great.
There are no flaws allowed. What's the flaw?
Is it a young adult story. I don't know. I'm getting tired of those, but...
Well, yeah. What? It's a young
coming of age story? Is that?
No. I loved the coming of age aspect of it. Like, I loved all of that, but I just don't... I don't know. We can get into it in spoilers.
Okay. Sometimes a spider boy becomes a spider man.
we don't have a problem with that.
It's hard to do a movie about Miles Morales and it not be a young adult movie.
No, in all honesty, I mean, it was absolutely amazing. My mind was blown the entire time I was watching. Like, is this really a cartoon? Like, that's what I kept saying to myself the entire time I was watching it. The whole thing. And the only thing I could say it took me back to, totally different kind of film, totally different kind of animation, but The Phantasm.
The Phantasm?
Mask of the Phantasm.
Yeah, Mask of the Phantasm. Like, to me, it was like, this is the same thing. It was like, holy crap, like, this is a great animated comic book movie, mm-hmm. and I can't get enough of this. Like it was awesome. I mean, like it was absolutely mind blowing. Every aspect of it, and things that I thought would be absolutely stupid made perfect sense. Like when they had the trailers and they had Spider-Ham,
yeah.
I was like, what? And then when I watched it, I was like, oh, that makes, absolutely, that makes perfect sense. It was brilliant.
Oh my gosh,
just
the and
whole
having
thing,
John
was,
Mulaney as his voice yes. was
yeah, yeah.
absolutely
was there was not a single, like, plot hole or anything in there missing. There was nothing that was like, eh, okay. You know, it just, the whole thing worked 100% and made perfect sense, and it was brilliant.
That voice casting is brilliant, too. Nicolas Cage
as Spider-Man
Noir. I had no idea.
Unbelievable.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Yes.
Chris Pine as the Disney Prince version of Spider-Man.
Yeah.
The perfect blonde version.
Yep.
Perfect. Every
I do like also that they referenced the other Spider-Man movies, like
yes,
mm-hmm.
yes,
and I thought that was brilliant. And every time they went back and said, "Hey, this is, you know, this is my Spider-Man story," I thought mm-hmm. that was fantastic. And my kids really enjoyed it. Charlotte actually enjoyed the Spider Girl with the robot. And I'm sorry,
Penny Parker.
Oh my god! Once she said "Konnichiwa," or is that what she said? She came in, "Konnichiwa," right?
Yeah,
Charlotte was on the floor. She mm-hmm. was just on the floor. She thought that was the funniest thing ever. She wants one of those toys, and she loved her so much. She connected with, I mean, it's funny that she connected with her mm-hmm. and not Gwen.
Yeah.
And
that's interesting.
She's weird that way. But anyway, but the thing is, there's something for everyone in this movie, and it doesn't dumb things down.
Yep.
It still makes it fun for the kids. Yep. The adults love it. And also, you don't have to be a comic book
No, you don't.
To appreciate this, because I am, like I've said a million times, I'm superheroed out completely. I just the less the better. But if I can get more Spider-Verse, I'm super happy, and it's really weird for me to say that. Because honestly,
it's really weird to hear it coming out.
Yeah,
of
it
your
is because I genuinely loved it. And then, you know, thinking about the films, the superhero films that I love. It's interesting to see my list of it being ranked up with like Superman the movie and Batman and Dark Knight and Unbreakable and even Spider-Man 2. Just like, I'm like, yes, it's that good.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, this ended up being, I think it might be my favorite film of the year. I don't know if that means it's the best film, but it's my favorite. I mean, it's the most fun I had at the theater this year. It was just a joy, as you guys have already explained. I share a lot of those same feelings. I do think, I will say one little nitpicky thing. The first few, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes, a little slow, tiny bit slow. But once it got going in full gear, it never stopped, and I was hooked. But I just didn't anticipate going in. I thought I was going to like it. I just didn't think I would come out saying, hey, this might be my favorite film this mm-hmm. year. And that's saying a lot, because I really loved Avengers Infinity War a lot. But this had such a different, obviously Infinity War, pretty heavy film. And this was the most comic book film I think I've ever seen. Really taking the medium of comic books and making it a film. I mean, it looks like a comic book on the screen.
Yes.
You know? It's just fantastic. Go ahead, Dane.
I was just going to say, I think one of the things that made it so enjoyable is that it just was itself.
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't connected to some franchise. I mean, it was, but the film wasn't connected to, you know, the next Marvel film. It wasn't connected to anything else. It just was itself. Mm-hmm. And that made it super enjoyable, because you weren't expecting it to go anywhere. It was just all enclosed, one simple story. You'd never seen anything like it before.
And it's the perfect story to do that, because it could be connected to all of that stuff if you wanted it to be, because it's a multiverse sort of story. You know what I mean?
Well, if you go in having seen nothing, you're good. But if you go in having seen all the Spider-Man movies that preceded it, or even the cartoon and all of that, you still get gets even another level out of it.
Yeah. Yep. It's very true.
Guys have, at the beginning of yours, did they show, like, explain each character's origin and who was the artist that drew them originally and all of that?
No. Where was that?
Well, again, I go to this wonderful theater, but they had a thing in front of it, and I didn't realize each of these were their own comic book series and where they right. came from and what they, and they introduced every single one of them. So you had
nice.
Context going into it that there were all these other things. I was like, oh, neat. Oh, wow. Oh. And then I just thought it was like a little thing to kind of get you into a Spider-Man mind. And then as I watched the movie, I was like, I am so glad I saw that because I would have had no idea there was a girl that would say Konnichiwa that had anything to do with Spider-Man, you know, yeah. had I not yeah, seen yeah. that the thing and, before.
And she said Konnichiwa.
I don't know what she said. I'm sorry.
Is she Hawaiian or is she Japanese?
I don't know.
Konnichiwa. I love Konnichiwa. That name.
The wrong.
I'm hanging on to that for the rest of my life.
Wrong emphasis on the wrong syllable.
Konnichiwa.
I don't remember what she said.
I think that was in Moana.
Isn't it Konnichiwa?
Yeah, it's Konnichiwa.
Konnichiwa. Oh.
Konnichiwa.
Konnichiwa.
Konnichiwa. It was just so perfect.
All right. On that wonderful note, let's give our reactions to the score. I'll go first. I also thought the score was excellent. Obviously, Daniel Pemberton. It might be my favorite score of this year. I know that's kind of a crazy thing to say. Again, it may not be the best, but it might be my favorite. It's a very diverse score, very, very diverse. It just has a completely different palette than anything else out there. The release has like 44 tracks. They're very short, which that I kind of regret. I wish there was some longer cues in there. It's very diverse. So if you're listening through it, you know, you're never bored because one track to the next is so radically different. But yet there's still obviously thematic connections throughout. And so I love the score. I really do. I love it being so creative, and I found it effective within the film. And as a standalone listen, again, maybe not something I'm listening to over and over and over on repeat, but when I listen to it, I'm going to listen to all of it. So I thought it was also excellent. Kristen, what did you think about the score?
It's definitely going to go into my productivity / workout mix. This feels so different than what we've heard from Daniel Pemberton. And I think it's awesome that he has this side to him. So that's really exciting for me. I love the score itself within the film. It works seamlessly with the soundtrack. Although on the soundtrack itself, I would have loved some Childish Gambino because Don Glover plays Uncle Aaron Davis in Homecoming. Mm-hmm. So would have loved to have a connection there, but not so much. Score itself. Effective. Liked it a lot.
Okay. Not so much as a standalone listen, unless you're working out.
I think I would listen to it standalone a couple of times, but I'm not sure it would be like a heavy rotation for me unless I wanted to have it as working music. It would be great working music.
Okay. Dane, what did you think?
Oh, I thought it was perfect. I thought it captured the story and fit the mood. To have the full orchestra, the hip hop thing, the DJ scratches, all of that, it just was so creative to me and in the way he approached it. And it has one flaw that I will mention, and it's Eric's fault that I know this flaw. And it's because the whole time I listened to it, all I kept thinking was, underpants. And I have no idea why that kept happening to me. I had to remind myself, no, it's Spider-Man. Spider-Man.
Were you thinking of Theodore Shapiro?
I don't know why. I just know that that little melodic...
Because they do sing Underpants and the Captain Underpants score.
No, I know. That's exactly why.
That's why
kids love that. I've heard it 1,000 times this year, all because of Eric, because Eric recommended it. And now I love the score. I love the Underpants score. So the whole time I hear that little riff, it's like, Underpants. And I was like, no, this is bad. It's Spider-Man.
That's but like I thought
you should go back and listen to I think it's Henry Mancini's Condor.
Oh yeah.
So because there's a
Condor
a vocal,
Man.
It's very much you can see where Theodore Shapiro was inspired to.
That's funny.
Do a singing choral theme for Underpants, but.
Anyway. Hmm.
Interesting. But other than that, I mean, I think Daniel Pemberton knocked it out of the park.
So, Eric, your box is empty, yet I know for a fact that you have a lot of thoughts about this score.
There wasn't enough room. No, look, I'm probably the only one that has anything negative to say about this. But first, I will preface this with some positivity. I do appreciate the creativity. Daniel Pemberton is probably one of the most creative experimental composers working out there, and everything he does is somewhat interesting, even though for me a lot of his stuff I don't particularly enjoy. I do appreciate the effort that went into it. Listening to him on The Annotator was enlightening. Mm-hmm. and I'm glad.
Thanks for the shout out.
Yeah, and I'm glad I listened to it. And I mean, I love that podcast, Chris, and keep doing it. It's fantastic, and more people should listen to it, because after listening to it, I had a greater understanding of what Pemberton was doing. I felt that he went a bit overboard. Some of the things that he did, I don't think he necessarily had to do, because it doesn't necessarily come across in the movie unless you really notice it. Mm-hmm. And I mean, again, as soundtrack fans, I mean, we do notice these things, but I didn't catch where he was, you know, re-recording or recording the score onto records and then scratching them back in. It just didn't come across. It's felt like record scratches to me. Mm-hmm. Now, if it's something that I noticed right off the bat, then I'm like, yeah, okay, what was that? And now I'm going to go back and listen to it. And hey, that's really interesting. I'm still interested in that. I just felt that sort of thing, and a lot of the stuff that he was doing was a bit overboard, but I guess as a composer, you know, you're always trying to do new things. I mean, it's a lot like what Göransson did on Black Panther, you know, all the recordings out in Africa and things of that sort. Does anybody really care? Mm. And you know, does having authentic African instruments really make a difference? I mean, did anybody know that Andrew Lockington did the exact same thing on his Journey 2 score?
Mm-hmm.
Nobody mentioned that. Nobody. Yeah. But hey, Black Panther is a huge movie, and all of a sudden, hey, Göransson's doing all this stuff. But I mean, those two composers did the exact same thing, but hey, one's getting noticed than the other. So look, I appreciate what he did. I just felt that it was too chaotic for me. Stylistically, it was just all over the place. I did like the theme. I like the Spider-Man theme. And when I first heard it, I instantly said, you know, Spider-Man in my head, and I'm like, great, yeah, he went, you know, the Richard Donner, John Williams role of Superman, and I knew that's exactly where he got that inspiration from. There's no doubt in my mind. You know, the main theme should say the theme of the hero.
Mm-hmm.
I actually did enjoy Prowler's sound, noise. Mm-hmm. I also thought that was being reincorporated into the, I'm going to say the Destiny theme or Destiny's music, the way that he was bending the notes.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not really sure if that's correct or not, but there's a point where it's a little more reflective, and it seems like Prowler's music is in that cue, and it's because of the representation between our two characters.
Right.
And I thought that was neat, but I just felt that once it got down to action music with everything going on screen, it was just competing with the sound effects in a bad way. It was just like, oh man, that final battle was sonically just bonkers.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, again, Pemberton went just a little too far where it became more of a distraction than something that was complementing the film.
Hmm.
I once said that, you know, it was probably one of the worst scores of the year, and I think it was just after my first listen on album, and again, not hearing in context. I don't think that anymore. I just don't it doesn't play well for me on soundtrack on the album. Like you said, it's like 82 minutes long, short mm-hmm. cues. It's not a very well produced soundtrack. Maybe if it was cut down to 40 to 50 minutes, I probably would have enjoyed it. But again, I think it's just, it's incoherent. It just doesn't mesh, but there are things that I like the theme, like the themes.
Yeah.
And the idea behind it.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's my rant. Sorry.
No, it's good. I mean, it's legit. Not every, you know, obviously not everyone reacts to every score the same way. Maybe the mix in the theater even had something to do with it. I thought like the most chaotic parts, it was so chaotic that like visually that what you had going on, at least when I saw it, the with the music and the sound matched the chaos. You know what I mean? And so it just felt like this, I wasn't really thinking about it at the time I was watching it. I wasn't thinking about, wow, chaos on the screen, chaos in the sound. It just was an experience of that particular scene. And so later then listening to the music, the chaos is there, but I remember the scene and I remember that experience being positive. You know what I mean? So I have a positive association with even those tracks. I will say this about the scratching though. And I can see where you're coming from in saying that, you know, did you really need to go that far with it? Because who's going to notice? But, you know, having, you know, when I was a kid in the early 80s and wanting to be a DJ and becoming a DJ eventually, and you know, having this rickety rack kind of setup of a turntable and how I learned to scratch, how I learned to mix, all of that stuff, and not playing any other instrument, and understanding the roots of hip hop, and these are the instruments of the street, essentially. You know, kids in the Bronx, New York, in the late 70s weren't, I mean, some were playing instruments, but a lot of them weren't, and these became their instrument, or this became one of their instruments. And to see him treat it that way, to treat it like an instrument in an orchestral, in a symphonic score, is, to me, it's like, it could be over the top, but it also feels like just next level. Like from that perspective of where DJing came from, at least in the hip hop sense, to see it incorporated into a score like that, I never in my wildest dreams ever thought that would happen, or even the idea of it. Like, wow, wouldn't it be cool if someone recorded their orchestra and then recorded it to vinyl or some digital equivalent and then use that to scratch within the score itself? I mean, that's just, that's three-dimensional scoring, like three-dimensional chess, that I just never thought, it never entered my head. And so when I learned about that, that just blew my mind off. And
I think from a composing standpoint, what you're saying right there, Chris, is the key for me. And it goes back to Goranson or Lockington and all of that. Subconsciously, when you're creating these other worlds, to go to Africa and get Senegalese instruments to create Wakanda, whether we recognize it within the context of watching the film or not, subconsciously, it feels right. So it defines the world. So to me, all of the scratching and everything, I was in, you know, I was there in that street, on the street with that kid and feeling his life. I wasn't projecting myself onto him or saying, oh, I get this because that was me. No, I was able to understand his story precisely because of the scratching and the hip hop and all of that. It just made it work for me, and it created the universe on a subconscious level. And combining it with the orchestra for me is like, well, obviously the orchestra is superheroes. You know, that is the adventure film sound, right? So to put the two together in that perfect marriage was like, it was, I mean, he knocked it out of the park in that way. It was just perfect soup.
But are you saying that in response to just having a DJ scratch and then having orchestral music playing, or recording the orchestra onto, let's just say, onto vinyl, and then having a DJ scratch with that recording of that score?
Yes, by recording the orchestra and then doing the scratching, that's next level. Had he done the scratching and done this, it would have worked too. Like, but by doing the orchestra,
and that's my point.
Yeah. But I think by doing the orchestra and doing that again, if the orchestra is the sound of the superhero movie, now you've taken the sound of the superhero movie and you're scratching it. What you're saying subconsciously is, here's a kid who wants to be a superhero, but he's from the Bronx, and his instrument is that. And to me, it's like a kid looking at a Monet and using a theme of the film, right? He's a kid who's looking at Monet, but all he's got is spray paint. And he goes down to the street and he does a beautiful work of art that speaks to him, but it's him seeing it this way and doing it his way. And to me, recording the orchestra and then scratching it is a similar effect, and has a powerful subconscious connection in your mind that helps you believe in this world.
Yeah, and that didn't come out at all when watching the movie. If they had just scratched along with the orchestra playing, like you said, you'd get the same reaction, which is why I think sometimes Pemberton just does a bit too much. And I just want to say, I have nothing against hip-hop. Because I'm sure that anybody's listening to this might say, well, he hates hip-hop. Like, no, man. I grew up on this stuff. So, like, late 80s, early 90s hip-hop was my jam in high school. And when I heard Black Sheep play in Spider-Verse, my toe was tapping, my head was nodding, and I'm like, oh, man, that's a deep cut. Who plays Black Sheep nowadays? Because that is one of the greatest hip hop records of all time. And it was one of my favorites. And I'm like, wow, that right there is next level stuff. So I do appreciate, like, rock and roll or hip hop or whatever it is that you want to use. I just feel that the recording of an orchestra on the LP and scratching it back into the score did not come across to me in any sort of conscious or subconscious level while watching the movie. And
you wouldn't know if it was subconscious,
right,
though.
But even if it's like, even if I'm watching it and like, there's times where, you know, like everybody says, like, you know, the best film music is the music you don't necessarily notice.
Yeah. And I don't know where that came from, but
John Williams said it.
I still say that.
No. And he doesn't necessarily mean it that way. He's meaning it as, hey, it's not necessarily calling attention to itself.
Okay.
It's a combination of everything together.
Yeah.
And I felt that there were moments in this where it was not working because it was calling negative attention to itself, which is really the only disappointing aspect about this, because it's sort of like it's sort of like Mad Max, where, God, I love that movie, but man, I hate that score. and I don't want to go through that again. It's not, Pemberton's score is not as bad. I will watch Spider-Verse and that's no problem. But, you know, it's things like Dunkirk. I want to watch it again. I might watch it with the volume on mute, and I think I might have a better time with it. But I mean, I do appreciate the filmmaking of that movie, but it's just like, oh my God, that score. And so, I appreciate that he did something different. He didn't just write a traditional orchestral score. I appreciate the hip hop. I understand it completely. I just felt that it was just a bit too much. It was too chaotic. It was a little all over the place. But man, when that Spider-Man theme came in, especially at the end, that was some powerful stuff. So, you know, it's hit and miss for me, but it definitely is lower tier Spider-Man.
I'll just make one last pushback on that. I think there is a difference in what he did versus just having some random record that they just say, you scratch with this because it sounds cool. Because he's scratching with the notes of the orchestra as recorded, and when he releases that, what he's scratching with, it is the note that the orchestra is then playing. Right. So it's not just some random sound that meshes well. It's beginning. He's scratching with the beginning of the first notes or whatever they are in the particular piece. that are about to play. And that's so right. That's what's like, what?
Yeah,
and you can't do that any other way. I mean, I guess you could do it in post, but that would be really hard to do.
That's making it a symphonic instrument. That's making the scratching part of the orchestra, and that's how he did it.
Yeah, yeah. And that's why I think I need a second viewing to completely understand what's going on. I mean, you know, we mentioned and talked about Remember Me by Olivier de Rivière, and how weird that score is, and it's doing sort of the same thing, and de Rivière wrote, you know, his orchestral music to work with the digital post-processing that he was going to do later. I didn't understand it. I mean, the first time I heard it, I'm like, what is wrong with the CD? And then, you know, listening to him talk about it, then experiencing the game, that's when I truly understood it. And I really had to watch a lot of gameplay footage because I didn't play it myself, but I mean, that's what I do with video game scores. And, sure. and I got it. I got that one a lot quicker than I did with this one. And that's why, for me, the context of this score, seeing it a second time and really paying attention to that score, because I was just so immersed in the story.
Sure.
But I did notice, again, the score was just pulling me out at some parts. But I do want to hear, you know, those things that you talk about where, you know, when does he release a specific note at a specific time in the score? And does that have an impact? Is that... Or is he just randomly scratching and it doesn't affect the movie? And that's what I want to get out of my second viewing. So, I might change my mind. I just, again, just first viewing and listening to it on album, it's just too much. It's too, and there's points where it even becomes a wall of sound. It really is just right in your face and it's all the same volume. And it's just like, wow, man, tone that down a bit, just a bit. You don't have to have all of that going on, and Pemberton does that. And I mean, again, good on him, wants to experiment, wants to do some different things. I've got no problem with that. I just think maybe he's doing a little too much.
Okay. All right. Let's go on to a little spoiler discussion, if there is any left, and some of our favorite tracks. I don't know if we have any left. Some favorite tracks that you had from, whether in context or just on the album, Kristen, we haven't heard from you in a while.
When I started listing favorite tracks, it occurred to me that I was just starting to list like the whole thing. Yeah. It flows really good. The one and only Spider-Man is great. One Spider-Man, well. Rather. Comic book, I love that cue. The Collider, I love the music to that. It's so disconcerting, you know. It kind of like messes with your equilibrium, and
I think that's what Eric liked so much.
You see, as an agent of chaos, I'm like fully behind the too much approach here. The Catch the S Train sequence.
Yes, that's amazing.
I'm pretty sure I turned to David in the theater during that and said, "This is dope. I love this." The Prowler. I loved his sound. I was really excited to have a movie with Prowler in it. So, oh gosh, that whole storyline, man. Through the cue list. I like it.
There are a lot of cues. There are a ton of cues.
There's a lot of music in this.
Yeah, there is. Dane, give me a couple of your beloved tracks or sequences.
You know what's really funny is I was listening to it yesterday, and it went into shuffle mode, and I didn't know it was in shuffle mode, and I was just like, man,
well, the order that track looks is random killer. To me.
And then the next time I was like, that track is killer. And then, yeah, so, but I liked Spider-Man Loves You. I think that's one of my faves. Shoulder Touch is one of my fave tracks. For the Love of MJ, Peter Enters the Spider-Verse, Ant-Man, the Spider-Shed. But, you know, one of the other things, nobody's remembers this because we're talking about the scratching and all of the stuff. The whistling. The whistling in this score was very,
very,
very cool.
That's very Pemberton-y.
It is.
Pembertonian.
Pembertonian, that's what I was looking for.
It's so cool to listen to. And my son commented, the one with the broken arm, he's like, He's like, Dad, the whistling is so cool. It's just so creepy. It's just right. That was his comment. But the whistling is one of my favorite things about it. That was really cool.
Yeah. Eric, your boxes are blank. I think that's intentional, but I could be wrong.
I don't have a favorite cue, but I can just say overall, anytime the main theme shows up, I enjoyed that. I got into Prowler's motif. I didn't think I was going to like it when I first heard it in the theater. I was like, oh no, not another noise for a villain. But it really worked. And then any of those more intimate or kind of reflective cues, they're far more dramatic. And I can't recall the scene. I think it's in Prowler's apartment. And what's our main character's name again?
Miles Morales.
Miles. Is he reading a letter? Or something along the line. Anyway, this is where I noticed that kind of variation on, I think it was, I want to say it's Prowler's theme, which gets turned into more of a destiny theme or a family theme or something like that. But anyway, the quieter moments really worked for me. And that really made a dramatic impact, a positive dramatic impact for me. So, I mean, no particular favorite cue, but anything that features, you know, the theme and Prowler's music and that sort of quieter stuff is what I enjoyed the most.
I agree. We've talked about most of the bigger tracks. I, too, love Catch the S-Train. There's another track that sounds similar. I forget the title right now, where it's just breakbeats and scratching, and it's just tempo super quick. I love that. But there... To speak to some of the variety of the score, there's several tracks. They're short, as all the other ones are, but just a different vibe. Mia Moore has a real tender, heartfelt, is a very tender, heartfelt piece. The Team Leaves is very melancholy. It has this French horn lead in it. It's just like, just stuff that you're just not expecting to really hear. And probably I probably didn't pick up on it at all watching it, but listening later, I was like, oh, wow, this is a nice piece. I wish it was longer. MJ in the Restaurant, it's like solo piano for a while, and then strings come in, and it's just like more of this. Saying Goodbye is pretty big, has some real emotional strings, and it brings in Miles' theme, the main theme, but in a real much slower tempo but lush way. And so it's these kinds of things that it took a while, a few listens to pick up on them, but as I did, it's like, wow, there's a lot here. I just wish they had room to breathe and to develop over a longer piece. Now, if he was able to write a suite or something from this, I think it would be fantastic to see something like this in concert. I don't know how they would do it, especially with scratching the orchestra. I guess it could work.
Well, they could totally do it. They could totally do it live. Absolutely.
It would be a fantastic show. So lots more to love. I love the big stuff, obviously, but there are some real short but sweet pieces in there as well. All right. Did everyone share their list? I think they did. So as we kind of wrap up Spider-Verse talk, where does this fall for you guys in terms of an overall Spider-Man film experience? Kristen?
Recency bias probably most definitely causes me to place this up top, but Spider-Man 2 is still way up there for me. But it's, I think because of the afterglow of this, it is really tough to make that call.
Okay. I know you hate doing that. That's why I asked you first.
I'm so indecisive.
Eric, where does this land for you?
Yeah, I have the same sort of thoughts. It's so, well, I guess I can't say it was fresh in my mind because I'm forgetting a lot about it, but it just made an incredible impression on me that I want to put it up near the top of my list of favorite superhero films. But I want to revisit Spider-Man 2 again, and I'd gladly do it as soon as possible, because I think that is fantastic. I just think it's interesting that both films feature Doc Ock.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, that was the shock for me. I didn't even see that coming at all.
Yeah, I didn't
like,
either.
Oh my God, that's that. And I was like, this is so cool because it's so different. And, yeah. and I love that. I mean, I figured out the Prowler Uncle surprise. No, that was easy. But this was like, holy
smokes. Yeah, I didn't
see
that coming at all.
So, but what I did really like about this, which is what I didn't necessarily like about even Raimi's movies or Homecoming, I'm not a big fan of these quick, jokey quips from Spider-Man. And I know that's his character, but I grew up... I understand that, but and I think I mentioned this before. I grew up with a more adult... cooler Spider-Man when I read McFarlane.
Seth MacFarlane?
No, the creator of... No, not...
please no.
Todd MacFarlane. Todd MacFarlane, sorry.
Please no, please no.
Todd MacFarlane's Spider-Man. And the thing is, Peter Parker was a more mature... he wasn't a geeky Spider-Man, so that's who I grew up with. And then, you know, seeing a goofy kid playing Spider-Man... really turned me off, and the fast quips and things like that. It wasn't what I grew up with.
All of his comics were super dark. I mean,
sorry.
All of his comics were super dark.
Right, that's what I appreciate. It's like I prefer the serious Bonds over the more goofy Bonds, Bond movies. So, but seeing this one and just the perfect tone of humor, every joke landed perfectly, and I wanted more of that. And that's the first time. In a Spider-Man movie where I felt that I needed more of that, the interaction between the two Spider-Mans, especially when they go and infiltrate the, I don't know the, what was it? With the whole bagel thing and everything. It was, it's just a, you know, the Doc Ock facility. Yeah. It was just so like there's so many little things that you'd kind of like, oh my God, so what did the person just say? What happened? It was just so much going on. There's no way this should have worked, you know. Multiple universes, time travel, or whatever. Those things. You're right. There's room for plot holes and problems. The script is amazing. It is so tight, and the humor is so good. The writing is so good, and I think that's what's going to put this one on the top for me with Spider-Man movies because it's so unique, but it's so smart, and it's just so well done.
Very good. Dane?
As I've sat here listening to you guys talk about Spider-Man 2, which has also been always my favorite, I think this one's better. I think this might be the best Spider-Man movie. And the only reason is because...
The scratching.
Yeah.
No? Oh,
subconsciously, okay. That's why I'm convinced right now at this moment. No, I think it was more, man, I can't even put it into words. The more I think about it and compare the two, Spider-Man 2 is so simple. Okay. The plot is simple. The story is simple. It's beautiful. I love it. I love the MJ thing. I love the ending of Spider-Man 2 when she makes her choice. I love the message of that. All of that. I love Doc Ock. I think the whole thing is just, it's great. But think about the complexity that's in this film. Mm-hmm. Think about all of the... There's a sci-fi element to this film. There's... Mm-hmm. I mean, there's so much stuff going on in this movie that... There are so many villains in this movie that I never thought I'd see. You got the Green Goblin. You got... who's the big guy? I can't remember his
Kingpin.
Name.
Kingpin.
You got Kingpin. And you got Doc Ock. You got... I mean, and the Prowler. You have all of these things going on. It's so complex. And yet... It never once breaks.
Mm-hmm.
It never breaks.
And you've got, what, six spider people?
Yeah.
I mean,
that's insane.
I didn't question any of the logic.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm saying. Like
that collider is there. Well, okay. Yeah. But who cares?
Yeah, it's true.
And usually I pick apart those type of things.
I think animation gives a license.
It allows you to suspend your belief.
You know what's funny, though, is that whole... facility was completely destroyed and then rebuilt in
seconds.
Right, seconds. And then it was destroyed again. And it was how does nobody notice that this thing is this has happened again and you still don't realize this is going on? And
this
I didn't even question
really
Kingpin's
rich, though.
I didn't even question the way Kingpin looked. It's so absurd.
Yeah, I mean, it just...
Yeah, it was great, though.
It was great.
Super stylized.
And how many times do you sympathize with the villain?
Yeah.
His motivation.
Yeah.
And even though it's wrong, but it's like, I'm like, I get it. I totally get it. And I sympathized with him completely. And the whole family motif was just so...
Oh, it's beautiful. Absolutely beautiful.
So well done. So
yeah. There was nothing about it that... was like, oh, they plugged that in. You know, right. There was nothing. It just felt right. Everything they set up was resolved perfectly. Like nothing was, you know, it's brilliant. And that's why I say it's better than Spider-Man 2.
Okay. And they killed Spider-Man. They killed him.
They killed a Spider-Man.
That's just nuts.
And they did it brutally. It was a brutal death.
And that's where I compare it to some of the best animated movies that I've seen. And I'm going to say it's the first two How to Train Your Dragon films where they are willing to go there.
Right.
They're willing to like say, hey, I know this is a cartoon and kids are going to see it. But you know what? This sort of stuff actually happens. There's consequences. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I appreciate them not dumbing down that stuff. And that's what makes this so great. It's so who the hell greenlit this? Right? Like seriously, think about it. Do we really need this movie? All of the Spider-Mans and you're thinking, what? They're doing an animated one? Come on.
Yeah,
it turns out this good, nobody in their right mind could have seen the success.
That's true.
Of this film. It's top-notch filmmaking.
And I'll echo everything you guys have said about Spider-Man 2. Although I mean the top of the list is The Amazing Spider-Man 2. Oh, no reaction to that?
Well, I haven't even seen any of The Amazing Spider-Mans.
There's only two of them.
Yeah. Hey.
And there's a reason there's only two of them.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It's like they're going to attempt another one, especially when the MCU has Spider-Man films. I was like,
what's weird.
Right?
After a successful, you know,
successful
version.
Using my question, though.
Yeah.
Aren't these the guys who were kicked off of Solo?
Oh, stop it. I knew that was going to come up. I can't believe this happened.
Hey, I didn't bring it up. So.
No, but they were kicked off of Solo by Disney, which has Marvel. Oh, yeah. And then they go over to Sony to do a Spider-Man. It's like this weird, like...
Mm-hmm.
But how great was this put together then? Like, I mean, were they already on Spider-Man while they were working on Solo?
I think they must have been. I think because
they didn't have direct this, though,
did they? Did they direct it?
Yeah. They didn't direct it.
I thought they produced it.
Two other guys directed it.
I think they produced it.
Yeah, they produced it.
But even the style, like, how do you even think about
it? Oh, every aspect of this was mind-blowing. Every aspect of it was.
Like, my wife didn't understand it. I had to explain to her why the color was off and why there was kind of like this 3D effect. And I had explained to her how old comic books were printed.
Yeah.
And she's like, oh, that's what that was. Cause like, it was so weird. It was felt like it was 3D. I needed 3D glasses and it was just like kind of out of focus or whatever. And the way it was blended. And I'm like, I'm going to show you my Spider-Ham comic book and I'll show you how it, you know, bleeds.
Yeah.
Out.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
That part of it, that's amazing detail that, I mean, you just catch that throughout the whole movie.
Yeah, absolutely true. That's why subsequent views are a must.
I think so.
Because there's so much going on. There's no way we caught it all in one viewing. Right. I don't think it's possible.
Here's what I take away from this movie that I think is powerful, which is we all were kids. We all went to see movies that, you know, made us fans of something, right?
Mm-hmm.
How many Spider-Man movies do you think my kids have seen? All of them except the amazing ones. including Homecoming,
so
right?
Like half,
But okay. I'm saying they've seen the Sam Raimi ones. They've seen Homecoming, right?
They saw three.
At any
Should
rate, my point.
CPS?
I'm trying to get my point. Oh my gosh. Okay.
All of them except half.
Yeah. Whatever. Konnichiwa.
No, you said it right. Konnichiwa.
At any rate, my kids, this was the movie that hooked them on Spider-Man. Like, this is the one. Even having seen all those other ones, that's not their Spider-Man. Miles Morales is their Spider-Man.
Wow.
And I think that's so cool.
That's so exactly, cute, too.
Like, that's their Spider-Man. And I think, to me, my takeaway from it is that that is what makes this more powerful than all of the other ones. Because it didn't hook my kids. Oh, Spider-Man. Spider-Man's cool. This one, Spider-Man, is like a freaking god. You know?
Okay.
And that's pretty powerful.
So to finish my thought.
Sorry.
This is on the top of my list as well, of all Spider-Man films to date, easily. And I'll just throw in as a bonus, what in the world, regular Spider-Man 2 was only okay to me. I was not a fan of the Raimi trilogy. I thought they were all okay. Well, the last one I didn't think was okay. But the first two, I just thought, yeah, that's fine.
Not even the delicious film score drama underneath Spider-Man 2.
Oh, yeah.
Well, those are the days.
No, I guess.
Whole other episode.
It was so amazing.
I guess I don't know the story, but
just Google Sam Raimi, Danny Elfman. I think it was.
Bring Christopher Young in. Bring John Debney in. Bring Deputy Lori.
Plus
for two or three.
This is number two.
Add Hellraiser to your Google.
This is
search.
What basically destroyed their relationship until they got back together for Oz.
Add the word pod person to the Google search. There is an infamous interview.
Okay.
It's crazy.
With Danny
the history
Elfman.
Behind that
it
score
is insane.
Does that make you guys like it more?
No, it's really.
It gives it lore.
It's juicy.
Oh, okay.
And especially then go and watch the subway chase or the subway rescue with Elfman's music and then Christopher Young's music.
Mm-hmm.
You're wondering, what in the world did Danny Elfman do wrong? And the thing is, I think
he didn't
it was
compose
Raimi.
Hellraiser. That's what it was.
Well, and he didn't, and he didn't write he wanted to do themes and variations. Like he didn't want to write the same score that he was writing with number one, and that's what they wanted. They wanted the same score. But to bring in Christopher Young, well, again, temp track played so much into the Doc Ock reveal, and it's like I remember watching that, going, "What is Hellraiser 2 doing in this?"
Because they licensed it. They literally licensed it slapped it in there.
Well, see, I thought he re-recorded it. I thought Christopher Young changed a few things. Oh, they actually licensed the oh, wow, that's bizarre. Anyway.
Yeah.
It's
I will check that out.
That's fun.
That's
a good
like a good
read.
Read.
Yeah.
Okay.
I love that movie.
Back. You'll enjoy that.
And all the juicy gossip under it.
Oh, yeah. And that's how Christopher Young got the job for Spider-Man 3.
Yeah, and that's why Elfman and Raimi broke up until... Yeah. Oz.
Oz, really? Oh, yeah. Oz, the TV show.
No,
the
James Franco in a balloon movie.
Oh, that Oz. Okay, gotcha. Huh. Very interesting stuff. I did not know it.
But we got dragged me the hell out of this.
Well, that's true. Okay, so that's gonna do it for this spidery episode of the Soundcast. Before we leave, of course, we want everyone to know how they can find and follow all of our wonderful discussioneers. Is that a word? I just made a word up tonight. Eric, the discussioneer, how can people find and follow you?
You can check me out on Twitter at SinSound Radio or on Facebook at Cinematic Sound, and you can listen to Cinematic Sound Radio by going to cinematicsound.net or through your favorite podcatcher.
Awesome. Dane Walker, how can people parenthetically find you and follow you?
Like all good discussioneer spider people, I'm on the web. You could find me at my website, danewalkermusic.com. Go anywhere, put Dane and Walker and music together. You'll probably find me there, SoundCloud, YouTube, you know it, and on Twitter as Maestro Dane.
Awesome. And Kristen Romanelli, discussioneer extraordinaire and interviewer of people of all types. How can people find and follow you?
Arigato. The easiest way to find me is on Twitter at KB for now. That's KBFORNOW. You can find Film Score Monthly online at fsmonlinemag.com. Also on Twitter at fsmonlinemag. We have a December issue out. It's pretty good. if I say so myself. But what we're really looking forward to is our January issue, which is 2018 in review, in which we have a whole bunch of articles from a lot of our writers discussing their favorite and not so favorite film scores from the past year. So check that out sometime in the coming weeks.
Sometime in January-ish. You can find and follow me, if you like, at C. Coleman on Twitter. Of course, you can follow the show on Twitter at Audio Soundcast, or even at Track Sounds if you want all kinds of soundtrack stuff. Reminder to leave us an email or send us an email. Don't leave us one, but send us one at soundcast@tracksounds.com. Leave a voicemail reaction to our discussion or to the movie Into the Spider-Verse itself on our SpeakPipe widget, or we'd love to hear from you on Facebook. So that's going to wrap up episode 128 of the Soundcast. Thank you all for listening. Until our next episode, we want to say konnichiwa.
Sayonara.
Sayonara.